But ladies and gentlemen, Reverend Father, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the historic Committee Room 14 of the House of Commons on what I trust will be a truly historic occasion when, for perhaps the first time within this building, the truth of the Assyrian massacres of 1915 can be broadcast and spoken about. And I'm delighted to see such a distinguished gathering of people, some of whom I'll introduce to you in a moment. Can I just firstly introduce myself, Stephen Pound, Member of Parliament for Ealing North, and apologise for the fact that there are a number of votes taking place at the present time. You'll have heard the bell ringing. That doesn't mean that one of us has escaped. It means that there's actually a vote taking place downstairs. So a number of members of Parliament hope to be here, but they'll come in and out. They will be coming in and out during the course of the afternoon. Before we start, it's not such a pleasure as a duty for us to see a very, very short film clip which brings into cold, precise, crystalline clarity the problem we face. And I wondered if you will, if my assistant is ready there, if you could just indulge us, just to see what happened a few days ago, was it?
4 months.
Four months ago. We're just, seen on you. But I think it's all the more important that we realise how vital it is that meetings like this take place, at which we can discuss quietly and peacefully and peaceably and positively some of the issues which still matter greatly today. They may have taken place 90 years ago, but the implications are with us still, and we've heard by the emotions engendered by that display there how live the issue still is with many people. This morning I tabled a bill in the House of Commons, which I hope will attract a number of signatures, referring to the massacres of 1915, because if 10 or 15 years ago we had to remind the world of the reality of the Armenian massacre, which after all, as Hitler said in, you remember, in 1943, who now remembers the Armenians? I think now the reality of 1895 and 1915 and the genocide at Aleppo and the thousands, if not millions, marched into the desert to die, whose bones are still being found. If we now remember that, I think we have a duty also to accept the similar genocide that was inflicted upon the Assyrian people. And here, this afternoon, I hope that we can make that information for widely known. So, ladies and gentlemen, I also said in my early day motion today that I consider that the actions of the present Turkish government are completely contrary to a government which aspires to take its place in the European Union. For all that is good in modern day Turkey, and there is much that is good, all that is excellent, all that is progressive, all that is positive, there is still, as we know, an apparent inability to recognise the realities of its predecessor Ottoman government. I find it difficult when this country and this government committed the most appalling sins over the centuries, but we accept them. We accept responsibility. We accept that we were complicit in the Irish famine, in slavery, in many things. But to deny that your government was complicit is to deny any hope to those relatives of the people who died. Because to deny that the genocide happened is to deny the real suffering of those people. And most cruelly, it is to try to deny the past that lives with every one of us today. We have to achieve closure on this issue. And the first thing that must be done is for the successor government to accept responsibility. That may be a while away. It may never happen. But we will try. And we will start that today. So ladies and gentlemen, could I introduce Mr. Sabri Atman to speak at this stage. So,
thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, I know you don't speak my language, Marbaya, so I hope you will understand my English.
Excellent.
There are two matters that need your attention: denial and remembrance. It is a known fact that whether committed in Africa or in Asia, the most common feature of all genocides is that they have been denied by the perpetrators. Turkey denies that in 1915 the Ittihad and Terakki regime, that an Ottoman government committed a planned, organized and systematic genocide. In Rwanda, almost 1 million Tutsis were massacred mainly in 3 months. Many of the perpetrators of this genocide were arrested and incarcerated. Do you know what they say on the massacre they committed? They called the event the so-called genocide. And this term has always been omnipresent in the writings of those that support the official Turkish narrative. The genocide of 1915 is still today a subject in Turkey. Orhan Pamuk is a novelist from Turkey. He was quoted early last year in a Swiss newspaper that 1 million Armenians were murdered in 1915. After this publication, his books were collected and burned on the streets in Turkey. But what I find most disturbing is those people who were burning Pamuk's books last year, were burning our people in 1915. Discussing the Assyrian and Armenian genocide is definitely a taboo subject. But as in all genocides, there are two different factions concerning this topic. On the one hand, there are those in the present government who hide behind the official thesis, and there are those that purchase in the interest of the people and claim that it's necessary for Turkey to come to grips with its recent past. These two perspectives on history existed in the past. On the one hand, there were those who planned the genocide to the last detail, and there were those that resisted the genocide and sheltered Christians in their homes. Sheikh Fethullah was a known Muslim cleric in the region of Margin. His portrait is on the wall of the Deir al-Zafaran, a historical monastery in Margin. The symbolic value of hanging his portrait in a monastery is to remember and honor him for his courage and conviction to act against what he thought was very wrong. That is the way it is in the entire world. It can be interpreted as a clash of good versus evil. To understand the 1915 genocide that was committed by in Turkey against Assyrian, Armenian and Greek citizens, you must first research the last century of the Ottoman Empire. Firstly, it is relationship with Britain, Germany, France, Italy, Austria, Hungary and Tsarist Russia need to be scrutinized and understood. In that century, the Ottoman state is unable to implement the reforms that European countries urge them to. The Ottoman Empire struggles with modernity and is labeled all over the world as the sick man. Many nations like Greece, Libya, and the Balkans gained their national independence from the Ottoman Empire. It is in this context that the Assyrians should live in their ancestral land, which are in the southeast of Turkey, namely in the regions of Margin, Urfa, Harput, Diyarbakir, Van, Bitlis, and Hakkari. When the First World War broke out, Assyrian national consciousness wasn't as developed as the Armenians who tried to defend themselves against the perpetrators. The war provided the Ottoman government with the unique opportunity to rid itself from its Christian minorities. They would be destroyed from the social economic fabric of Ottoman society, and it is precisely this destruction resulting from deliberate and systematic stance from central authority that it must be called genocide. In this genocide, hundreds of thousands of people were brutally slaughtered without any mercy. Not even the women and children were spared. Many people were thrown alive into water wells, which were later on steel. People were put on boats and taken out to sea, pushed overboard and left to drown. Hundreds of thousands of people were massacred by sword, safe. Women were raped, parents were butchered in the presence of their children. Hundreds of thousands of people were intentionally left to die of hunger and thirst in the wilderness of Mesopotamia. Great pains, great tragedies were experienced. Prior to the First World War, the population of Turkey was 14 million, and 4.5 million of those were Christian people. In other words, 33% of the population were Christian. Today in Turkey, the total number of Christian people only amounts to 0.1% of the population. What happened to these people? What happened to the Assyrians, Armenians, and Greeks? Where are they? Where they disappeared to? Would not this diversity of people be a great wealth to a country? Then what happened to Turkey's greatest effort? It is ethnic diversity, the annihilation of this mosaic of colors and diversity, but deliberately. Yes? Deliberately. Yeah. Tragically accomplished, more than 2 million people were massacred and over 2 million people were forced to the faith migration. No one who can say wars, massacres, and tortures taking place in many parts of the world today has the right to think that our appeal to recognize a supposedly forgotten genocide is meaningless. This is because opinions like this are not right. Genocide is a crime against humanity. And there is no statutory limitation for a crime such as this. Such a crime should not be forgotten, and if it is to be forgotten, it can lead to enormous disaster. During the Second World War, when Hitler ordered the genocide against the Jews, Gypsies, and all the democratic people, it is known that Hitler said, "Whoever mentions the genocide of the Armenian people today?" It is clear to everyone that Hitler took an opportunity due to the silent ignorance and forgetfulness of the international public. If the international public, democratic opinion and countries had not overlooked the genocide of our people in the shadows of the First World War, would Hitler have been able to implement a second genocide in the shadows of the Second World War? This is why we speak to the silent majority. The aim of bringing the issue of the genocide of the past to the forum today is discussing them. It's not just to condemn them. This cry is equally important for people from different religions, races, and cultures who exist in democratic societies and continue to live in security. Only such societies which possesses a democratic mechanism and functions may remain distant from all kinds of oppression and massacres. It should be clear that the massacres and the genocide that have been carried out until today share a unique characteristic, which is that they were all implemented in democratic countries and by forces opposing democracy. It is therefore important for us to know in what kind of society and world we would like to live. Do we want to live in society of equality and brotherhood between people from different racial, religious, and ethnic backgrounds, or in societies where some brutal forces do not show even a modicum of tolerance? The source of the problem is not the diversity of ethnic backgrounds. The source of the real problem is the inability to accept and tolerate diversity and beauty. Kemal Yalçın is a Turkish author living in Germany. Yalçın has done interviews on the genocide with many an Armenian and Assyrian. His book contains a passage of an old man that summarized the emotion and thoughts of many Assyrians. The old man spoke as follows: "Few of us have witnessed the great, horrible catastrophe, but it won't have shaped our memory. I suffer even from its memory, even though we didn't experience those frightful days, those caravans to death. We bear their scars on us. And what did those that experienced those days do? In our region, the killing of the Armenians was delegated to the Kurds. Everybody knows this. The Kurds use the term the infidel massacre. I have to point out that the term infidel, gaur, is a condescending term to the big Christians in Turkey. I am by no means accusing all Kurds or Turks. My anger is directed to those that planned the catastrophe in this time. I will be relieved when all this is brought to light and is acknowledged. I don't hate the Turks or the Kurds. They should be ashamed of themselves, but I pray that God will have them punished. Ladies and gentlemen, these are the emotions and thoughts of the Assyrians as well. Our issue is with those that planned and implemented this genocide. Perhaps you will think that this is odd because the perpetrators are all dead. Yes, they are. But it is on their heritage that the country was founded. The modern public Republic of Turkey was founded in this manner. Turkey was homogenized, and this was slowly endured to the perpetrators. It is not an exaggeration to claim that the economic prosperity of successive political elites in Turkey could only be related to the genocide of the Christians. And I am not aware of any serious research on this topic of Turkey so far. The effects of the genocide of 1915 were both economic and political. The present political elites are still denying the genocide by asserting the following statements. The event is a historical event. Leave it to the historians. I must say that these theses emanate from Turkey's wish to pacify and forget the whole issue. If it really wanted to leave it to the historians, they would have been more tolerant to dissenting academics. But we all know that it is impossible for any historian to freely speak and write on the genocide. With respect to this aspect, Turkey is far from being a democratic society. Democratic societies don't have taboos. The descendants of Assyrian, Armenian, and Greek victims of 1915 request acknowledgement and apologize for the atrocity within the framework of international law. Without this consistency, it is inappropriate for Turkey to assist the European Union. We think that acknowledgement of the genocide should be a precondition for membership of the European Union. Acknowledgement and apology is the only right step to be taken with reference to the genocide. Turkey will benefit greatly from critically scrutinizing its history because it will receive more international respect. Denial will only bring the opposite. Acknowledgement of the genocide does not only imply social maturity, but also prevent future outbreaks of violence and persecution. Turkey reckoning with its past, a growth of respect of human rights and increase of democratization will prove to be a great asset for the entire world. First and foremost, Turkey must reconcile with its past a nation that is afraid of reconciliation has no future. Now the genocide topic has become a daily debate. We see once again the Turkish official embrace nationalist propaganda. Still today, they cover up the real truth with vast misconceptions and deceit. We are told the Christians collaborated with foreign enemy to destroy their state from within. And of those who were migrated, were affected by bad weather, condition and fell sick, and died of hunger. Of course, they said that some incidents happened which were neither wanted nor approved of. They are saying there is no need to magnify this event. These people are not embarrassed by the genocide, and they are not ashamed to be the grandchildren of those that perpetrated the genocide. And what is worse is that when they are pushed into a corner, they threaten, "Do not enrage us or it will be repeated." Ladies and gentlemen, is there a difference between the mentality of the perpetrators of genocide and those that deny one? The mentality I am talking about is in power today. This way of thinking is what we are opposing. We have no intention to foster hostility or hatred against Turkey or the Turkish people. Let us be aware that Turkey's sordid past cannot be cleaned away with threat of "we will do it again" or "we will crush you forever." First and foremost, the Turkish state, which carries on its shoulder the historic responsibility of the Assyrian Armenian genocide, owes us, the grandchildren of the victims, an apology. I believe that the initial condition for eliminating this problem is not to compromise with historic brutality. On the contrary, it is about not compromising. Every great nation has its disgraceful pages written in its story. But what is important is what the nation learns and embraces the chance to take responsibility, not just for the past, but also for the future generations to come. Willy Brandt was the Prime Minister of Germany. While visiting Poland, he visited a monument to the Jewish victims of the Holocaust. He approached the monument, went down on his knees and apologized. This gesture from an honorable statesman opened the way to improve the relations between the German and the Jewish people. It is well known that Willy Brandt actively struggled against the Nazi regime and that he lived in exile as a result. As an individual, he bore no responsibility for the Nazi brutality, but as a German, he realized this was about collective responsibility and that his nation must apologize to the Jews. Willy Brandt gave the first step on how a nation can take responsibility. And the Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his Foreign Minister Abdullah Gül, what have they done? Are they able to demonstrate the same grace statesmanship as Willy Brandt? Yeah, they are busy protesting against the monument in France for the Assyrian victim of the genocide. Finally, I would like to point out the following. The Assyrian genocide is not known globally. An unknown and denied genocide inflicts great emotional pain on us, children of a people victimized by genocide. many of our contemporary societies' problems can be deduced from the genocide. Even though the democratic world has failed to prevent the genocide committed against our people, it has to cooperate and to alleviate the problems we are facing today. As the first genocide of the 20th century, the Assyrian one should be offered to all universities as a topic of introduction into the crimes against humanity, committed wherever and by whomever. Genocide remains genocide. It survives the traces of time. The historical profession is not only an exercise in constructing the where and what of fact, it is also a means to cope with the past. Past genocides have to be known and condemned in order to prevent future genocides. And this is precisely why the Assyrian genocide should be known and considered. It is a big mistake to think that it lies in the past and should be forgotten. History is not about oblivion, it is about knowledge, it is about education, it is about future. Those that suggest we should forget about the genocide are having difficulty understanding us. These people have no idea about the socio-economic, political and psychological effects of genocide. Forget about us is their advice. But is forgetting that easy? We Assyrians have lost 2/3 of our population in 1915. We were uprooted from our motherland. The remnants of the genocide were cast into distant parts of the world. Today, we are struggling with our shared existence. As I said before, many contemporary problems are a product of the genocide. How can we forget about all this? My personal experience is that I saw my grandfather often crying when I was about 7 or 8 years old. I was a child, and I couldn't attach any meaning to my grandfather's crying. I just knew he needed his 3 brothers. That's all I really need. I have just learned of these details only a year ago from a 97-year-old woman whom I met in Germany. She told me that all my grandfather's brothers were killed in the genocide of 1915, and that he used to mourn about them. Since I found out about this a year ago, I have often dreamt of my late grandfather who passed away 30 years ago. They are telling us to forget about all this. How can I forget this? How can I forget my grandfather, my village, my homeland, my loved ones? All this is my personal story, and it is impossible for me to forget about them. Of course, the disease can never be returned, how much we want, but Turkey owes us an apology. It must acknowledge the genocide. Acknowledgement will be very advantageous to Turkey, to augment its international respectability and to strengthen democracy. Denial, on the other hand, will only bring the opposite. The children of Assyria are waiting for what all children need, a sense of right and wrong. Thank you. Fatima Rama.
Thank you very, very much indeed, Javier. I think every one of those words still hangs in the air in this room. They're powerful words, but they're words of truth. They are undeniable words, and I use the word undeniable deliberately. Those words will be disseminated throughout this building. We were hoping to have Rajiv Murshid with us, but he was unable to enter, I believe, so Ninos will speak in place.
Thank you. As MC Stephen Pounder said, Rajiv Murshid was hoping to attend this event, but unfortunately he was not able to attend physically. However, this does not preclude him from getting his message across. So he asked one of us to kindly, on his behalf, read out his personal message which he was intending to give at this event. I have to stress at the outset that the author's opinions are his own, and they do not necessarily reflect my own, but I am fulfilling my obligation and promise to Rajiv of sending his message across at this event. Shlomo, Shlama, dear guests, first of all, I would like to thank the members of the Ravil Institute, which has organized the conference and invited me to deliver the speech. I would also like to extend my gratitude to all of you here for coming and participating in this event. I am aware of your sensitive approach and interest in the topic. What happened in 1915? Was it the outcome of a general war which led to conflict between nations, where almost every individual was affected by that common catastrophe? This phenomenon, can it be named genocide? Myself, I find all debate on the naming of this phenomenon meaningless. Changing the name of an object does not mean we have actually changed the object itself. The incidents that occurred in 1915 took place before the eye of thousands of people, hundreds of diplomats, historians, lawyers, and many Western aid organizations in the area. Today, there are countless documents and correspondence in the archives of different countries in different languages. More importantly, the genocide is a historical event which is still freshly preserved in the minds of the actual victim societies, nations. There is hardly anything left unknown, undocumented, that hasn't been brought to light about the genocide. With this genocide, the oldest inhabitants, nations of our geography, with their religion, culture, and countries, were annexed and annihilated. West Armenia, Cilicia, Pontus, and Assyria. Even their names don't get mentioned. They have been wiped off from the geopolitical map. The victims of the genocide were not only those who lost their lives in the genocide. There were also the orphans who were left behind, the young girls who were taken into slavery, those who had to hide their identity or change religion, and those who were forced to emigrate from one place to another. And the tragedy they went through has created a permanent victimization for the generations to come. The geography we live in, that is, from the Black Sea to the Gulf of Basra, from the Caspian Sea to the Mediterranean, from Near Asia to Mesopotamia. I am talking about a large area where so many countries, nations, religions, faiths, and cultures are blended into each other. For a century, due to genocide, exile, persecutions, and wars, became an area of national disasters. The question is not whether the genocide took place or it is not happening anymore. The question is, what should our stance be towards the genocide? For me personally, the actual problem is to heal the wounds caused by the genocide and exiles, to eradicate the hatred and distrust through dialogue between those peoples, societies, that once were living together. To be able to achieve that, countries, governments, and political organizations must abandon their self-centered, politically calculated approaches to the topic. In particular, on the side of the perpetrators, issues such as genocide, exile, ethnic cleansing, and national hatred must be confronted, questioned, and be condemned. I believe that no political entity can resolve the genocide situation unless the genocide is recognized as a historical reality, condemned by the public conscience. Unless we embark on our historical duty to heal the wounds of the genocide and start a comprehensive struggle to discontinue the influence of denial and its effects created on the general public. Unless we rid our societies with this genocidal mentality which denial is part of. Unless we go through a thorough confrontation with the genocide against these nations, we will not be able to become persistent democrats and have democratic entities. We will also miss a valuable opportunity to initiate a common hopeful future for all these nations, religions, and different cultures in our region. Despite official denial in Turkey, it is hard to see that the genocide and its effects are being picked up and discussed by larger groups. Unlike the past, there are more academics and researchers going beyond the official standard thesis and divert themselves to different phenomena. More books and articles are being published. Little in numbers, but honourable, educated individuals are struggling to break the taboos. Nevertheless, such struggles are giving a life of hope against an ocean-wide policy of denial. However, all this is not sufficient. To say the least, a careful and detailed work and studies on the extermination of one of these nations in 1915, that is the Assyrian, is relatively new. Generally, no attention has been given to the Assyrian genocide of 1915. During the genocide, the same policies that were implemented on the Armenians were implemented on the Assyrians as well. Despite their name not being mentioned in the legislation produced by Etihak and Taraki's administration to displace Tehjir, the Armenians from the homeland included the Assyrians too. This legislation also included the Assyrians, the Pontus in the Black Sea, the Greeks in the Near Asia region, and the Yezidis. To a certain extent, we can say that this was a policy implemented to purify the main Muslim population from local non-Muslims and carry out an extensive ethnic cleansing. That is why, at present, the oldest inhabitants of the region, the Assyrians, are outnumbered in their own country to an extent where they can hardly be called even a minority. By not disguising the historical darkness and pits of dirt and filth, or by confronting them and bringing them to light, I believe we can construct and build respect and acceptance based on multi-ethnic and multicultural values of our region. A real dialogue can only be obtained by open-heartedly discussions. I must stress that the hurdles and reactions that have been demonstrated so far forces me to be a pessimist and hopeless. As a society, or as individuals, we should be putting these questions to ourselves without fear. We should not be in fear of the answers. While the crime of genocide is so near us, in a touchable distance, we should face it and confront it. For almost 30 years, I have been active in the studies and polemics of the Kurdish political history. As a follower of this cause, Kurdish, I can easily face the dark pits, gaps, and unclarified paradoxes in our Kurdish history, which has resulted in the tragedy of our neighbours, the Assyrians. There are people who assume that if we succeed in changing and blocking what the conventional official historians are claiming, then we will be reaching the reality through a shortcut. This is a completely misleading approach. There will always be something missing and leading us to a destructive consequence unless we understand and elaborate the cultures and histories of other nations that live together. The darkest period of our common history is the genocide of 1915. I think the key answers to many issues related to our history lie in this genocide. Such civilian questioning and trial will put the planners, organizers, and conductors of the genocide, the Ottoman administration and its follower, the Republic of Turkey, in the difficulty of hiding the reality and gaining public support. In conclusion, I would like to state that I am profoundly sad for the destruction, sorrow, and historical injustice that the Assyrians went through. I am also sad, despite my comprehensive and precise work on the political history. I only became aware of the Assyrians' national disaster recently, and hence have not taken action on it earlier. I am hoping that this nation will accept my apology and honor me with their sincere friendship. Yours sincerely, Reshef Mereshi.
As you see, we can't have you leave the room, I think, because you can't go for the voting point tomorrow, so I'm sure you'll be back in a few minutes. I'll introduce the next speaker, Nina Kubova is a Syrian-Armenian filmmaker from Yerevan. She's made one of the outstanding indictments on the Assyrian genocide issue, which was seen a few days ago, and that she will be our next speaker now, I think.
Last year, we have done one documentary about who already Assyrian or one who Armenian. And the film is about Armenian Assyrian genocide. And it's called A Forgotten Period of One Nation. One of the most significant human efforts is aspiration to morality. Our inner stability and human existence is regulated by it. It is the morality of our being that adds beauty and dignity to our life, others and time. The great Einstein has said in Armenian or Russian Einstein, idea became the basis of our documentary field exploration. It opens the drives of human activities which lack morality and become violent, which that must be answered for. Even more, it is wavering its directives towards the total eradication of a nation and is correctly called genocide. Each genocide must be convicted and the nation which suffers from genocide must at least get moral repair. The sources of the film are from many textual archive materials which are provided by the Institute of Armenian and Yerevan Armenian and by the Publishing House in Sweden. Many scientific research and works have been studied concerning the genocide. Today there are few researchers concerning the Assyrian calamity. I can say the whole of the most information is gathered from the documents and research of Armenian genocide. In this film, documentary clips and photos of the Armenian genocide were used. There is another issue I want to point out. It appears that today we practically Assyrians do not have any specialized counter documents and clips, photos on the appearance letters neither in Armenia nor in European countries and the US. I'm sure that they exist, but we need to research and find them. Along with appearance archive photos, we use clips and photos referring to massacres, but almost all persons to Armenian massacres. We were accused of showing Armenian photos while speaking about the Syrian genocide, but I would like to announce that we show massacre photos and clips only when referring to slaughter, destruction, and violations in general. We just use them to show the event of massacre. And in this case, we are for every nation which has been subjected to genocide at one time. Also, in some areas, it was a mixed population of both Assyrians and Armenians. For example, a picture from Kartuz, Hamburg, could be an Assyrian or an Armenian victim. We have, of course, the historical data with utter carefulness. As you know, it is important to be cautious with your data because it is a genocide that we are making a documentary on. We understand that historians are allowed to have a various assessment on certain historical events. The historical information included in our film, however, is taken from books, archive materials, and interviews with different historians. I assure you that nothing is made up in this documentary. Or, for example, discussing the Orthodox churches and the Hakkari mountains, all information we have followed significant Russian and Armenian sources. Armenian and Russian sources are of a pivotal importance among other sources, for example, German and British sources. And there is also an interesting fact which I would like to mention. The Armenian language doesn't exist as a Syrian nation, maybe because unlike the Ottomans, the Armenians did not have an interest to divide the Syrians. The Armenians in Armenia all are Assyrians. The Nestorians, the Orthodoxes, the Chaldeans, the Protestants. For example, in Armenia, Turkey, Syria, Iran, which no, not after the rendezvous, Syrian Orthodox Church, until the Abdulatan of Akar, and finally, Syrians, as after the some Armenian traditions about the Syrians are used in the film. For example, the Hakkari Highland Assyrians of all provinces were called Kilos, Kelone, in Armenian Turkey. Even Assyrians from Kerbala province were called Kilos. We too call them Kilos in the film, while the Assyrians know that Kilos were only the Assyrians of the Kilos Assyria. Assyrians of writers, I admire them and their patriarch Mashimun. Among them, prominent Armenian writer Rafi, who we have quoted several times in the film. Gilos were isolated from the outside world, entirely concentrated within their country. A Gilos was famous for his impudent, explosive, and quarrelsome character, but he was also courageous and kind at the same time. And the next one, Mashimun's example is an exception in the entire world of Christianity, where the spiritual father is a simple hero at the same time. In the Ottoman Empire, the Armenians and the Assyrians lived side by side, and often a hamlet would be of a mixed Assyrian and Armenian population. These two Christian nations faced the same fate. To speak about the Assyrian tribes and not to mention or not to show respect to these two sister nations, it is just impossible. And I think that the collective effort and united struggle for common calamity is the only right and successful path for both nations. During the early resistance of 1 in April 1915, many Syrians from the surrounding territories fought along with the Armenians. The priest Kasha of a Syrian populated village of Khanov had failed for the incredible challenge and Syrian death. There was also another Syrian barrier named Sahar. These examples are warmly preserved in Armenian stories. Much can be said about sympathy and fraternal love between those two nations. When in 1914 the famous Armenian commander Andranik, together with his volunteers, came to defend the city of Sarai of the one village, he was welcomed by the Assyrians, and after the battle, the graceful Assyrian gave him a skeleton, her name Aslan, that later became his most faithful comrade in arms. During our shootings in different countries in the Middle East, where many Assyrian communities are spread, in Assyrian people's families, I often stole the picture of Andranik Ozanian, which is carefully saved with the other photos of the ancestors. They speak about great love and gratitude of this nation towards the prominent Armenian hero. In the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, the Syrians were spread over the Indian part of the Ottoman Empire in the village of or state of Van, between Kharder, Diyarbakir, Sebastian, and others. From a religious aspect, they were distributed into three main groups: Nestorians, Catholic Chaldeans, and Jacobites of Central Africa. In the Ottoman Empire, nationality was determined by religion. The point of such life, Spartan's policy was to disunite, then exterminate the Assyrian nation. According to this policy, there were no Assyrians in the Ottoman Empire, but only Nestorians, Chaldeans, and Jacobites. It's impossible today to be the exact number of the Syrians living in the Ottoman Empire, as the policy demanded reduction of the Christian number and increase of the Muslims. There have been numerous questions regarding accuracy in figures. As a rule, the statistic of the Christian people was conducted by their respective clergymen. There were lots of slaves, though, where churches and pastors did not exist. The Christians lived together with the Muslim majority. Thus, numbers were discussed, but very often the Christians themselves deliberately reduced their quantity in the hope to escaping Turkish attacks and terrorist tactics. The Russian Deputy Consul of the Vandivarek government reported that, to his knowledge, there were 237 Assyrian families living in the Assyrian villages of Beyl, Eli, and Fatih of the Hakkari Kavala province. Official numbers show it only 77. There was a huge discrepancy between the actual and official numbers of the Christian population in Turkey. Most of the time, the Christians themselves intentionally diminished it. As a Russian researcher from Komikos reported that in 1830s, towards the beginning of the 20th century, the Assyrian people exceeded 860,000. In 130 dwelling places of the Umayyad region and neighboring Persia, they amounted to 100,000. During our research, it was difficult for us to give direct number of Assyrian population in Ottoman Empire. Different historians have different approach to this problem. Some scientists of Södertälje University in Sweden, who research Assyrian genocide today, have found facts in documents which have come out very recently. They are from clerks of the priests living there and military archive documents. There weren't such documents 10 years ago. So the new facts and documents bring new information about the democracy and massacres. I'd like to share with you the facts which we met in southeastern Turkey during the shooting of our film. Facts did via that one move between Hatari, Diabatis, Muslim media. It was the way of our journey. Everywhere there were desolate villages, houses, desecrated churches, and attempts to wipe out places of the indigenous Armenian and Assyrian people that lived there. The man whom we met in Hakkari called himself Muslim, but to the question what was his nationality, he answered, "I am Muslim, but my parents are Armenian. I don't know Armenian, but my uncle and aunt still speak it." According to his opinion, which is assured that of its accuracy, nearly 4,000 Assyrians and 2,000 Armenians still live in Hakkari. Many of these people have lost the language and assimilated with the Kurds living there, but some of them have preserved the language and used it secretly. All former names of Assyrian villages in Hakkari region are crucified and by renaming them as some Turkish names. When we asked the volunteer of the Turkish army near Diyarbakır city, now the city is called Hakkari city, how to get to Kuşadası village, which had been guaranteed president of Hakkari Mahmud, he answered. There is no Kuşadası anymore, forget his name, there is Polak. A blue-eyed boy whom we met in Mardin swore in the Quran that his grandmother had been Armenian. I think it is difficult to imagine how many deeper Armenian and Assyrian testimonies like this there are. What does all this mean? How do you construe desolated areas, defiled churches, traces of forced Islamization and crucifixion, or the fact that today the results of forced assimilation are becoming clear? And last but not, what can be said about a nation that was driven away from its historical land? To juxtapose all this with Emperor Daniel, what else can we be called if not a genocide? According to Professor Mikhail Sladokhan's Peter's book, Religious Holy Academy, what was that if not genocide when the Syrian people were deprived of their homeland where they had been living for centuries? After the events of 1915 and the First World War, the Syrians had lost their historical homeland. They were deported, scattered throughout the world, becoming emigrants forever. The Armenian scientist Dr. Lawrence Bakterian correctly states, today appearing together with Armenian struggles against the ignorance of the genocide. Both nations have enriched the world civilization through their such historical stages as a nation would be proud of. During the 1915-1918, one of the world's most ancient nations, the Syrian, suffered huge loss. We must bow our heads before the hundreds of thousands of Assyrians graves without conscience, because neither the Armenians nor the Assyrians have conscience on their graves. And once again, one of the most significant human efforts, aspirations to morality, our inestability and even existence is regulated by it, and it is the morality of our deeds that adds beauty and dignity to our life. With Einstein's work, we can evaluate and define nation's goal and mission under narrative cards. Time has an incredible ability to erase everything from human recollection and sink the error and goodness into oblivion. But there is a kind of recollection in the corner of which the moral efforts of our deeds are being collected. It is the reminiscence of our the soul, which is an unchangeable essence with its numerous stages where the facts are being recorded and they never pass in the forgetfulness. Thank you.
My name is Aras Yerakian. I'm an Armenian historian and I'm also a lecture teacher. I really wish that Mr. Tan was here because some of my experience was addressed to him and his colleagues. First of all, I'm humbled to be here as an Armenian historian because in some ways I feel guilty that often the feeling that it's not the same of his spirit as the part of Armenian. This is highly due to the demographics. The Armenians is the largest community in Russia and part of the Assyrian, that's one reason. The other one is that the story itself is chosen to be the Assyrian experience out of historical narrative, including many of my own colleagues. So I would like to associate myself from that part of Armenian narrative historiography. I think it's wrong, and I think it will change the question of time. I would also like to congratulate Professor Theodore Institute. I'd like to congratulate our teacher, the Syrian or Syrian, and I'd like to congratulate you, because in some ways today's event reflects the caliber of the Syrian diaspora in this country. It shows that you're not an ancient nation for the Conservative Museum, you're a modern nation with a perception for the future. You're standing up for your rights by being here today, by serving you out here today in a thoughtful and powerful manner. And I think your ancestors should be family, but I think this is also not a losing battle, but a winning battle. This is the beginning of what lies ahead. And there's grounds for optimism. There's also grounds for optimism because we also have people like Reggie Marathi, a Turkish intellectual, and more Turkish intellectuals, Kurdish intellectuals, who are addressing the Syrian issue today with an open manner against their own authority, against the Turkish state. And once the capital is back, the truth will prevail. The Turkish state, once it loses monopoly over what can and cannot be said, and with interest in itself, then I think the whole energy will struggle. It's quite some time. And my own experience is that most Turks are open to be convinced on these issues. Most of them, we can say, to get over them regarding the reality of the Armenian genocide, the Syrian genocide, the Greek genocide. Most of the young people today, you don't want to have the burden of the past on their shoulders. They don't want to go online and living as a nation of liars, if you will, always try to hide the crimes that weren't committed in place now modern day Turkey. So I think there is grounds for optimism. And we're here to not think of it because we like struggling. We're here today because we would like to win on this issue. But we would like to reach a point where we will make them recognize, and they will recognize because they accept what their ancestors did and what, in a sense, they owe to us. It's not just a matter of closure, it's a matter of restitution. We keep talking about it, but it is important. It's not about just the grave of our ancestors, it's also about our churches, it's about our culture, it's about the very geography that lies within Turkey itself, which is still being ruined today. If you go to Eastern Turkey, as Dina mentioned, there are still remnants of our culture that still remain there in ruins and are still being ruined today. And the situation goes on. The Armenian, given an example, the Armenian city of Kars was kept intact until very recently because it was used as a story. And 2 years ago, it was given away and lost. The good side of the story is that it was to survive. But elsewhere, you find out that everything is going to disappear. Thousands, 1500 year old churches and structures that are falling apart. And in a sense, this is what we're trying. We want to lay claim to that. The artifacts that tie us to the past. Now, we're here today, this is Holocaust Memorial Week. It's Holocaust Memorial Day of the week is dedicated in this country, Great Britain, to remembrance of the Holocaust and other genocides so that we can learn the lessons of the past. Right? So that we lesson about genocide, there is a lesson about racism. And in some ways, the faith for the human genocide has a very important lesson for us today. And that is not simply the truth about the state for itself and the catastrophic losses, but it is also about a genocide of Turkish state, rather Turkish nationalists, that still denies what happened in 1916, 90 years ago. The denial of the crime of genocide is part of the same point as the act of committing a genocide. Like any criminal act, right? Covering up the act is part of the criminal capital. And we are in that stage of the crime that was committed, and is still being committed against the Assyrian people, but also the Armenians and others as well in the church itself. So these are very vital lessons for Holocaust Memorial Day, because if Turkey gets away with this kind of genocide in the 21st century, it becomes an example for future states to commit genocide in a similar manner. Turkey is actually giving a prototype of how do you commit genocide and get away with it in the 21st century. So it does a very vital significance that should concern us, not as Assyrians or Armenians, but also as British citizens, as Europeans, and as members of humanity. It is very relevant to all of us tomorrow day as well. So, two questions I have. Is it reasonable for us to raise the Assyrian genocide question here today? And secondly, is it reasonable to expect the British government to assume a special role in addressing this issue now? And I would say the answer is yes on both counts. The first one is something I touched on, the morality and politics of it. But the second one, why should the British government take an active role in this issue? And the answer is, I'll repeat the question. Why should the British government take an active role in recognizing the genocide against Armenians and Assyrians? If the British government in 1916, in publishing what the symbol, the British Parliamentary Report, which was called the Treatment of Armenians in the Ottoman Empire in 1915, outside of the word Armenians, the British government articulated, first of all, gathered enough information about the destruction of Christians in Ottoman Turkey while the crime was being committed. And secondly, it articulated, it put together the evidence and confronted the genocide thesis, as we even know it today. The document was called the Treatment of Armenians, but the context is actually about Armenians and Assyrians. Often when Assyrians were murdered alongside Armenians in deportation caravans in Aral massacre, their identity was subsumed as Armenians. Because they were minority, most places like Acre, Erzurum, Siva, Tabriz, when Christians were massacred, the majority of them were Armenians. So often in describing what happened, they were the Armenians are being massacred. But if you read the actual details of these reports, you find out that there are Christians and there are Armenians and Assyrians. Right? It made no difference whether you are Armenian or Assyrian conquered in 1915, because your family was in the same. And they were sent on the same caravan and they were murdered in the same manner. The Blue Book actually also has an entire chapter about the massacre of Christians in northwestern Iran, in Hakkari and Azerbaijan, I should say. In that case, the proportion of the majority of the victims are Assyrians. But what it showed, the British report showed that already in 1916, the British government had enough information from reliable sources about the destruction of its minority, let alone the information that came to the fore after the war was over. And I can see this because what the British did was they showed not only individual massacres, because if you show a massacre of Christians in one area, in Patrick, or a massacre of Christians in Mara or Siva, it doesn't mean it's a genocide project. What the British did, in a very clever way, in a very advanced way, if you will, they argued that the massacre that we're seeing in these different areas is part of a general conspiracy, it's a common pattern of destruction, under the forces of the state. And they argue that the only way you can have a common pattern of destruction, systematic, is if a state is involved, if there are orders being given from the center, from Constantinople itself. So it was a very systematic piece on the Armenian genocide. It's a milestone in our understanding, and it's also a very systematic piece on the faithful, on the Syrian genocide as well. So this is the level of British involvement from 1915 already, and the Parliament. Is it relevant? Well, I'll get one thing. The Turkish government certainly thinks it's relevant, because only less than a year ago, the Turkish Parliament, every single Turkish Parliament, had signed a document, a letter, that was addressed to British parliamentarians, saying that the British Parliament, like 19 years later, should rescind this report. They argued that this report was a complete fabrication, it was concise, that the author, Arnold Poynier and James White, and Poynier specifically, actually admitted that it was contrived, that it was simply British wartime propaganda against the Turks. And if you look at the letter that says Parliament, which is not in the library of House of Commons, it's one argument of the argument with academic citations. My job as a historian was to examine the citations, because citations are all British archives, right? And if you look at that, the argument that presented to British parliamentarians, you find out that even today, the Turkish parliamentarians are forging, even less than the British parliamentarians. If you look at British archives today, the documents they are citing actually say the opposite, right? And Corning Edison said, Corning to his last dying day affirmed the veracity of the genocide that was carried out in Ottoman Turkey against Christians. Yet Turkish parliamentarians today, 90 years later, every single one of them, imagine 550 people, none of them, the British members of parliament, trying to coerce them, trying to hoodwink them into agreeing with them that in the best interest of the area, in the best interest of Armenia, Syria, and Turkey, they should rescind the propaganda publication. So certainly, the Turkish parliamentarians feel threatened by their own history, by the documentation of the genocide that was committed against their own minority, and they feel compelled to try in some way to restrain, to undermine a real research and real understanding of these issues. Of course, all this backfires, because it draws attention to the continuing denial of the Syrian genocide, and the complicity, not just in one particular parliamentarian, but every single member of the British Parliament today. Right now, the petitions are among parliamentarians to give an answer to the Turkish letter, and I hope that that's just a time I can see the Chinese as well as yet, or a done so. So, the Assyrian, the Armenian issues very much alive today, and I have to see that even more and more alive, because as long as Turkish state says nothing of the sort happens, then their vulnerable position, because the archives of the world today demonstrate the veracity of what happened, and not just the British archives. The amount of information is overwhelming, and even some of the most disgusting type of information, and I'll give you some of the information I have at my disposal, which I come across through my research. I was once working on the Diabetes Division in Occupation 1915. And I came across a letter by an American patient called Floyd Smith. Floyd Smith was an American physician. He was a doctor in the psychiatric, in Armenia. In 1915, he described how Assyrians started coming to his clinic. And because he was a medical doctor, he wrote reports of his patients. And we have some of those reports today in American archives. And these victims, these Assyrians were victims of the recent massacre. We know the date of the massacre, we know the name of the village, Karabash, and he described people with limbs half sewn off. He described people whose skulls had been cracked open with part of the brain protruding. Alright, it's kind of the English woman, one of the descriptions. This is a sort of a medical report of an actual massacre. It's overwhelming because we have actual reports from Smith himself. It's not something somebody else said something here. These are the actual reports. He talks about people who have hardly beheaded and have been surviving. And then he talks how the awful authorities stop his patient from coming to the other agency in the clinic. Alright? And describes how we try to go to the village himself and how we would stop them going. So the state, the government, instead of stopping the massacre or allowing them to treat patients, is actually facilitating the massacre and making sure that the patients die. So this is the type of information that we still have today in our life. This is information our church has stumbled across. And if the church is saying can be denied, one of the most powerful weapons that we have is to present a very powerful case against it. Because the information still exists today in our time. This is one archive, one folder for one missionary. There are probably dozens and dozens more in that particular archive, and there are dozens and dozens of other archives where we are working. Our meetings in this sense are much further ahead than the theory. Again, there are good reasons for that. The theory is a small community, they don't have a republic of their own. And also, this kind of work is being done now amongst our new generation because our grandparents, our parents' generation were refugees. They were not in a position to actually argue their point on these issues. They were too busy trying to survive in the Middle East, in a very turbulent Middle East, in 20, 30, 40, 50, 60. It's our generation, we are assured of where we stand, we are economically in a secure position, we are bilingual. Right. And we can argue what the English language, with everything going for us. So the Turkish government currently has a denial, and we have it within, in that the Turkish government within Turkish land. It's only a matter of time that the Turkish state has to recognize the veracity of the Armenian and Assyrian genocide itself. So, and all this discussion today we're having is part of all of the moral debate. This is, whether we have genocide or denial of genocide, is part of the same coin. And if we are going to stop genocide occurring again in the future, we have to become cognizant of how genocide takes place, but also after genocide takes place, how the state tries to get away with it. You will have to how they minimize the scale of the crime, how they minimize the number of the culture, how they try to blame individuals rather than groups, and how the state tries to flee from responsibility. So, and in this sense, the theory of genocide, the Armenian genocide, is very much relevant, is very much part of the British experience. And this is just a valid avenue, a truthful avenue in which we can tell our own narrative, and we can also come up with suggestions how we can reverse some of the traits of the legacy. In the case of Armenian and Assyrian, what is the difference? One is that much of our cultural artifacts still remain in places like Turkey, which we like to preserve. Secondly, I think, as Lena mentioned, there are still Assyrians and Armenians and Christians living within Turkey as Christians. They've had their identity suppressed for three generations, but already have individuals coming out and writing a memoir saying, yes, I come from an Armenian family, or my grandmother was Armenian. And you find out that these are the living victims of the Armenian Assyrian genocide. There are sort of thousands or tens of thousands, but there are hundreds of thousands of these people. Right? And they in a sense are part of the legacy of the genocide that was committed against us. But they're also the living victims that we can still reclaim by allowing them to come out. And in some ways for us to reconnect with our Assyrian in those parts of the world. Assyrians and Armenians are in some ways present within the Republic of Turkey. Yes, they are Turkish citizens, there's nothing wrong with that. If Turkey has become democratic, I think we'll find out that there are a lot of our kids and kin still living on those lands itself. And this is something that we should struggle for and keep in mind as well. So the Holocaust Memorial Day, I think we should try to connect with mainstream by showing how our students connect with their British experience and with the wide investment of genocide in denial, but also recognition have to offer for us today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Could I apologise to Lena Yakubova for having to go down? We had a couple of votes, unfortunately. I didn't hear the bell in here. I just suddenly saw the sign come up for the division. But I also say that last year, when a number of us presented a petition to Downing Street calling for recognition of the genocide and arguing against the Turkish case, at that particular time, the Bryce Toynbee report, the Blue Book, had only been published in its unannotated form. The original Bryce Toynbee report did not list the name and place of origin of witnesses. It did not include witness statements. It did not include statements from particularly people living at the time in San Francisco and Los Angeles, where many of the victims fled. It did not include any of the Caribbean statements from a very large community in Paris. Last year, Bryce Toynbee was republished in a fully annotated version. Two volumes, I have it in my office. And for obvious, when it was first published, the names were not listed because the people were living. Now, sadly, they are dead, but thankfully their names have been listed. I am not a historian, but if the Bryce Toynbee report is not accurate, then quite frankly, it is one of the most extraordinary documents in the history of the world, because were that not to be accurate, hundreds and thousands of witnesses would have to be proved to be lying. I find that impossible. I've had two meetings with Turkish groups since the letter that was referred to, and of all the mass of information that was given to me, I was able to substantiate every single one by one. I have to say, there was an attempt in the 1920s in San Francisco where some photographs of Kemal Atatürk were frankly forged. Photographs which showed Atatürk with his feet on an Armenian child. Those were forgeries. I can understand why. One forged photograph 80 years ago in San Francisco. One massive two-volume history of the horror, annotated by independent witnesses, annotated by British and French and Italian, and even in two cases, German witnesses, at the time when this country was actually at war with Germany and its ally Turkey. So, let there be no suggestion. Let us never consider the possibility that this massacre, these massacres, did not take place. For anyone to imply that this was starvation or food shortage, or as the Turkish group who last met me said, it was internal migration. It was people moving about Mesopotamia who decided to leave their villages, to leave their homes, to leave their families, to leave their water, to leave their orchards, and walk into the desert, as if anyone would do that. To imply that that happened is to twist the knife in the heart of every one of you who had relatives who died in that horror. And that is a vicious cruelty. To malign the dead is a sin so grave that it should have its own name. The name that we use is genocide and denial. In my borough of Ealing, we recognise Holocaust Memorial Day, and we recognise the wider Holocaust. For the last 5 years, we have prayed on Holocaust Memorial Day, not just for the souls of the 6 million Jews who died in the last war, but for the millions of Armenians and Assyrians who died as well. And I know that there are many of you here who brought this matter to the attention of one small London borough, Ealing, to make sure that at least one day a year your name is heard on the town hall steps when the mayor will actually read out the reality of that genocide, where the Assyrian priest, Father Stephen, will be present, and where we will respect and acknowledge that. Can I advise all of you who live in other boroughs, contact your members of parliament, contact your mayors, contact the leaders of your council, because virtually every council in this country recognises Holocaust Memorial Day. Let those councils recognise the wider Holocaust. Let them recognize the deeper genocide. Let us not try to expunge from the pages of history the horrors of 1895 and 1915 because it may be expedient. Because there may be a wish not to offend the Ankara government. That is almost irrelevant compared with the recognition and the reality of the past, because if we do not accept the truth of the past, how can we accept the reality of the present and hope for the future? We have to accept that this happened. We have to recognize, and we have, as every single one of us who calls ourselves a human being or a democrat, we have to weep for those victims. And we have to promise that it will never, ever happen again. And we have to swear that the successors of those responsible admit their culpability. It may well be inconvenient. It may well be awkward. It may upset the apple cart of expansion of the European Union. So what? When your ancestors died in the most horrific circumstances, had they been told then that their death would be denied, how much greater would their agony have been? Had they known as they died that 90 years later their voices would be heard, then that might have given them that little bit of consolation. They might have known that they did not die alone, forgotten and denied. They might have known, had they known that, it would have consoled them. It is our duty to offer that balm of consolation to those who are beyond our reach, but to those whose suffering passes down the bloodline today, and, possibly more importantly, to those as yet unborn, who when they talk to their parents and say, "Am I an Assyrian? Am I an Armenian?" And the answer is yes. Be proud. Be aware. Know your history. And know that however people may wish to deny that history, the truth is as sure and as strong as the sun that rises in the morning. You can no more deny the existence of the sun than you can deny the reality of the massacres that were inflicted on your people. I promise you that there are many of us in this House of Commons who will continue to transmit your words, not for any ignoble reason, not out of misplaced sympathy or sentimentality or anti-Turkish sentiment, but out of the emotions of justice and right and respect and admiration for a people who were not wiped from the face of the earth as the Ottoman Empire wished you to be, a people who spread across the globe and flourished in every single place you went to, a people who rose to success in every single walk of life, from music to theatre to literature to art to medicine to politics to music, everywhere you will see Armenian and Assyrian people today. A nation that was not crushed, a nation which took the most vicious and cruel blow, but survived and prospered. That says much of your strength. It says much of the futility of the Ottoman Empire then and the Turkish government now, who think they can suppress that unique strength and courage. My friends, they will not succeed. Today, here in the House of Commons, I hope we have put down a marker. This is not the end, but this is the beginning. This is the beginning, and the end will only be reached when, in the Turkish Parliament, an apology is given. May that day come. I thank all the speakers who spoke today, spoken with passion, but spoken from a depth of great knowledge. I'm not sure if you wanted to finish at all, really. I know we have to be out of here in a minute, don't we? Yeah. So, can I then just repeat my thanks and apologise for a large number of MPs. Peter Kilfoyle particularly wanted to come and be with us. There's a number of other MPs who did. Unfortunately, as you can see, we're on clause 102 of that debate at the moment. And all I say is that one day, I hope we can meet again and we can look at a copy of a Turkish newspaper that says, yes, we admit. Yes, we accept blame. Your ancestors, our fellow human beings, deserve no less than that. Let them have their rights. Let them have their recognition. And let the message go out from here today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. No, thank you. I have to say, you were very good. You're not an actor.
Sorry, I would just like to say something very shortly. We would love to seize this opportunity and really thank you, Mr. Stephen Pound, for helping us.
Thank you, sir.
And thank you very much for your friendship, and we would like to present with you which you have particularly written.
I'm not sure I'll enjoy it, but I'll read it. Yes.
You know what I mean?
No, I know what
I mean. I thought it was informative.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Well, I thought that was a friend of ours. It's only one of the people.
Even one. Huh?
It's just the other one.
Someone is obsessed with you.
Thank you very much. I would love if you could ask him about the role.
Sorry?
I would love if you could ask him about the role.
Alright.
So, am I still recording?
Yes.
Mr. Hollis.
Hollis Manning.
Honest, it's from Premier Radio. She's a very good friend of the Assyrian community. She's the only hope we have in the sense of getting our voice to the British public.